Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hello and welcome to season 4, episode 39 of Undermine, brought to you by Osiris Media. I'm Tom Marshall, your host, your guide, your time traveling show Sherpa, as we revisit and relive Phish's famous Fall 97 tour. That's the tour where Phish destroyed America, at least according to the marketing materials in advance and to the majority of the fan base after. We are diving into each show from that tour on the actual 25th anniversary of when it was played. And that's been our season. And joining me on this journey is my frequent co-host, fellow Undermine executive producer, and New York Times bestselling author, Benji Eisen. If you're watching on YouTube, he's the other guy here with equally good looks. Hi, Benji.
Hi, Tommy, can you hear me?
Oh, loud and clear.
It was a Who reference.
Who's on first?
Exactly. You know, we should have done that gag for Quadrophenia. But anyway, let's get right to this. Today's show happened today, 25 years ago, in Philadelphia, December 3rd, 1997. It was the band's fifth show at the venue. The fourth was just the night before, as you guys know from yesterday's episode. So we are talking about the second night of a two-night run, and a Wednesday night at that. So we're just over halfway through the week, and it's halfway through the tour. Now, Tom, since this was before the age of the pocket download, where you could listen or even watch the show from your couch in real time, many fans at each of these concerts were hearing the sounds of Fall 97 Phish for the very first time.
Yeah, you've been kind of mentioning that throughout this season.
Yeah, well, that's because it's true. And then Live Phish came along and totally changed the game. You know, first by offering next day downloads and then streams. And now, of course, we have live webcasts of every show. That's why I no longer miss a note in real time. If Phish is playing a show and I'm not at the show, I'm on the couch.
watching football.
Well, dancing is the sport of choice, as they like to say over at Fantasy Tour. So I guess, my point is that if I'm not inside the venue, then wherever I am, I'm streaming live on Live Fish. I've even done it on my phone before, at the beach.
Well, you keep mentioning Live Fish, and it's funny you should say that, because you know who the guest is today. But for those who don't, our guest today is Nugs.net and Live Fish founder and CEO, Brad Serling. So you can thank him for the upgrade. Should I bring him in from the waiting room, Benji?
Not so fast, Tom. I mean, yes. But first, whether you're on the couch or in your car, if you're enjoying listening to us talk fish with Tom Marshall, then please consider joining Osiris Premium so that we can keep this party going. You'll get bonus episodes of Undermine and our sister podcast, HF Pod. You'll get ad-free episodes, access to the Under the Scales archives, meet and greets, AMAs, and even the chance to be in the hot seat on one of our shows. So check out osirispod.com/premium, or just click on the link in the show notes.
It sure is a whole lot of bang for the buck. Check that out for sure. Are we ready now for Brad Serling?
Almost, Tom. We'll get there, I promise. I know that Brad can't wait to talk to us today, because I've been texting with him leading up to this, and he remembers Fall 97 as fondly as we do. He uses the same quote-unquote earth-shattering and life-changing language that we all use. But look, we all have a lot of memories of these Fall 97 shows, and so we want to hear from the listeners as well. So to the listeners, we want to hear your stories, and we will, if you just simply make a 1-minute video clip, share your story, tell your tale, take us back to Fall 97. And if you post the video on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and you tag Osiris Pod, you'll be automatically entered into our fun little game, in which a random storyteller will get the handwritten lyrics to Ghost, care of the song's lyricist, who also happens to be your host for the series. In fact, I'm looking at him right now. It's Tom Marshall. Tom, have you ever actually written down these lyrics before?
I wrote them down once for Trey. okay. Benji, I'm bringing in Brad Serling from the waiting room. I think I should.
Yeah, thank God. Please just do it already.
Well, Brad Serling is a friend of mine personally, and also a great friend of Osiris, having been on every fish podcast we've created. And I want to say thanks for returning, Brad. Let's see if he pops in from the waiting room. And there he is. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Hi, Brad.
How's it going?
We are doing great, and we are excited to talk about this show here at the Philly Spectrum. So you were here at the Philly Spectrum with me on this night, December 3rd, 1997. But give us a little context, a little background on what was going on in your life at that moment. And also, just to fill me in, because I know this, but I don't remember. When was your first fish show?
So I first saw the band October 1st, 1990. And that was at the Haunt in Ithaca, New York, because I was a freshman at Cornell. I was 17 still, because of a late birthday. And I had seen Six Nights of the Dead at the Garden in September. And so my first fish show was only 11 days after that. So that was a pretty strong way to start college, and pretty much set the tone for the rest of my undergraduate education, was seeing the Grateful Dead as often as possible, seeing fish when they were in town, because all my money was going to Grateful Dead to go on tour, so I could only see fish when they were around. And then look at me now, all these years later, where I made it my job, because I pretty much majored in it in college, much to the dismay of my parents.
So, Brad, you were a taper. And even recently, when we started talking about having you on the show, you sent me a photo of your dads from this night.
I just found them right after you asked me about them.
Yeah. For listeners that are streaming instead of watching, Brad did just hold up what I believe to be the authentic dats.
These are actual dats. And in fact, there's the deck that I bought on eBay in anticipation of this podcast. None of my dat decks were working after I found this tape. So I was like, well, I probably need another deck anyway. So I went on eBay, found that nice Panasonic SV3700, that arrived last weekend and doesn't work. So I have not been able to play these tapes. But of course, there's many other places where I was able to find recordings. And like I was telling you guys earlier, I don't know why I never made CDs of these tapes. Back at that time, like by 98, 99, I started taking a lot of the DATs I was making and started putting them on CD just so they were easier to listen to, because DAT decks can be finicky and a pain in the ass. I never transferred this show. So I don't know what that means in terms of how I felt about the show at the time versus the rest of the tour. You know, I had gone to the Hampton shows. So Tom, to answer your other question, where I was at the time, I was living in New York City. I was living in the East Village, actually living in the building, Red Square, the same building where Bobby Sheehan was in the penthouse. Warren and Steph were in penthouse G, I think it was. I was on the 8th floor. Chris Barron lived there. The Superfly guys later lived there and, you know, ran Bonnaroo the first couple of years out of there. Randomly, that's where I lived, 96 to 98 in the East Village in New York. So, you know, going to New York shows was easy. Spectrum was pretty easy. And I grew up in Philly. So going to see Phish at the Spectrum was very important to me because it was, you know, hometown. And I have a lot of friends in Philly still. So I remember taking the train down, which was pretty simple. I mean, you could just get to Penn Station, go down, you know, make it down to the Spectrum, see the show, and catch Amtrak back that night. So I'm pretty sure that's what I did this night, because I think I just came to the 3rd. I didn't go to the night before. And I only found tapes of this night, which leads me to believe I only went to that show.
Nice.
Tickets long gone. I used to collect all the tickets and everything. Then once I started working for Phish, it just like, I stopped. Yeah. I have a box full of shit somewhere, but I couldn't go back to the ticket stubs. But yeah, so I remember training down for that show.
Well, on this tour, you know, at the time in 97, I made it a point to befriend people like you. I made it a point to befriend the tapers so yes. that I could get a good line into the first generation tapes within a week or two of the show, which back then was considered lightning fast. This was before Live yeah. Phish came along. So, you know, I always assumed that tapers like you had their own inner network. Did you get tapes of this tour before the Philly run? I know you were at Hampton, but did you get tapes of any of the other shows?
Yeah, I taped Hampton myself. And then I had friends who went on to Winston-Salem. Wasn't that right after? I can't remember the order of the tour, but yeah. So I think by the time I was at the Spectrum, I did have tapes of the other nights. I don't think I had every night, but I had... I did not send my deck on tour that night. By summer 98, my deck would go on tour even if I wasn't there. And I remember picking up my deck at the Lemon Wheel, and it had been on the whole tour. I'd been to a bunch of the West Coast and some of it, but fall 97, I had some of it. And then I remember going, I think by the time I was at MSG, I had heard most nights at that point. And everyone was raving around about the Nutter Center show, which I didn't go to, but... you know, like I was saying, at that time it was actually pretty rare for me to travel for Phish. I did travel for Hampton, so that was kind of a big deal that I did a weekend just seeing Phish, which I guess I had done the Gorge that summer. I made a trip, and living in New York, that was a pretty big trip to go to the Gorge just for the weekend. That was probably the first big trip I made just to see Phish. And mostly that was just because of money, not because of desire. You know, it was expensive to go out, you know, and I had a full-time job in New York City. So it was easy to see things around the city. Whereas Grateful Dead, I would always drop everything and go, because it felt like a ticking time bomb. You know, like you didn't know how many more shows you're going to get. Whereas with Phish, it's like, oh, they're going to be playing, you know, to always be able to see Phish.
Another 40 years.
Right, exactly. who would have guessed back then?
So you've you've confirmed a rumor just by talking. I think you've confirmed it here that the fastest way of getting tapes is actually record them yourself that night.
Actually taping the show was and that is why I started taping. I mean, that's why I started taping with the Dead in the... summer of my first Dead show was actually at the Spectrum, same place the show we're talking about was at.
Yeah.
That was 9/8/88. And I, you know, did not tape, didn't really know anything about taping, but it took about a year and a half. By summer 90, I started taping. I bought my first tape deck, which is actually sitting right here. Actually got to use this tape deck. I don't know if you guys went to the Grateful Dead meetup at the movies, but we ran we had a 60-second Nugsnet ad at the beginning of the Europe 72 show they played. And
we couldn't get the licensing in place to use actual Grateful Dead songs. So I had to pull out an audience tape because my DAT decks weren't working. Like I said, I had to pull out the actual analog cassette deck, which, you know, for those of you at home, this is what I brought on summer tour 1990. And, you know, I taped from 90 to 92, including Fish with this, and switched to DAT by around Vegas 92 Dead. I was already using DAT, but still had cassettes sometime, then phased out the cassette deck. But yeah, so that on that Nugsnet ad, we had the audience clapping Not Fade Away. That was the music that played in front of 500 theaters around the world last weekend, which was pretty exciting for me to hear my audience tape from 1990 being played theatrically. It's pretty funny.
Before we move on, I want to say, Brad, you know, I've always relied on the kindness of tapers. And yeah. So especially back then. Now, of course, thanks to you, I don't need to rely on the tapers. I need to rely on your businesses. I've always, you know, a big shout out to the tapers for letting all of us hear the music back in the day.
Big shout out for sure. And also it's sometimes it's easy to tell. I mean, when you hear Brad's passion, it's sort of easy to extrapolate the career that you went into because you're clearly passionate about it. And it's fun to hear. Let's talk about this night. The Philly shows have a certain notoriety to them. I think Trey loved, you know, he was into the hockey team, into the Flyers. He'd seen the Flyers there several times. What do you remember about the scene on these nights?
Well, the Spectrum was always a great scene. I mean, particularly for Dead shows, which is, you know, when I literally got on the bus at the Spectrum, it was, you know, I just saw the vibe of the crowd, and it was the whole stereotypical thing of the band sings the line from Truckin', you know, sometimes the lights all shine on me, you know, what a long, strange trip it's been. I remember the lights coming up on that Spectrum crowd, and I was like, oh my God, you know, and the whole scene in the parking lot was incredible. So that was 88. Fast forward to almost 10 years later, this is December 97, you know, almost 10 years after my first Dead show at the Spectrum. The scene was pretty much the same. I mean, Philly was known for the Nitro scene. I don't know why. I think it's just because, you know, the South Philly mafia playing off the cops, whatever. It was always, you know, it was a very heavy Nitro scene, always a great parking lot scene. Because there were great parking lots, there was a lot of like expansive parking lots that were official lots right around the Spectrum. So it allowed for a great parking lot scene and people would get in there early. I came in the train from New York, so I don't think we were hanging out on the lot that particular day, but you have to walk through the lot from the subway station. So, you know, I remember it being crazy and hearing nitrous tanks everywhere and people selling shit. You know, it was a full-on shakedown street scene, you know, in the classic sense. That's what was happening that night for the Fish show. Absolutely.
That's how I remember it as well. And it's interesting you bring up the sprawling parking lots around it, because I do remember that it was surrounded by parking lots. And also there was the Holiday Inn that was adjacent to it and spilled over. The scene in Philadelphia was always very... The birds of a feather are really flocking outside in big numbers. But, you know, the Spectrum itself, as I think, Tom, you were hinting at this, the building itself has a history to it that is almost as storied as Madison Square Garden is in its own right. You know, it was then home of the Philadelphia Flyers. For me, it was a hometown venue as well as for you, Brad. So I saw, you know, Billy Joel there. I saw just a lot of the shows in my youth. Do you have any particular memories or hot takes on the venue itself, or at the end of the day, was it just the geography and it's just, you know, a typical NHL hockey arena?
Well, for me, it was the musical memories. I was never really a big sports fan. While lots of my, you know, Philly is a really big sports town, you know, four great teams and great stadiums and arenas, including the Spectrum. You know, I remember JFK, you know, which was legendary for Live Aid and all these crazy things. So Philly was always a great concert scene. And that's what I remember about the Spectrum. In fact, my partner in Nugsnet, John Richter, has two seats from that original Spectrum, which they tore down. Pearl Jam was the last band to play there. They did this Halloween run. Then they tore it down in, what was it, 09 or 07, or I forget exactly what year it was. But that was a sad moment when the building went down. And at this point in 97, they had already built the new Spectrum, which was across the street. And it was confusing. There were basically two Spectrums, but they had different names depending on what the branding was. But this Fish show was at the real deal Spectrum, the original Spectrum. And I remember I think it was the first concert of the new Spectrum happened to be Oasis. And I came down from New York in 96 with a girl from my office. And I was kicked out. I was kicked out of the Oasis show for dancing in the aisles with this girl. Whoa. And it was funny, just the scene. That was the new Spectrum fall of 96. And then back of the original Spectrum, December 97 with Fish. Nobody was getting kicked out for dancing in the aisles of the Fish show. But it was just a... So I always held the new Spectrum. I was like, oh, that place sucks. I don't want to go there. You know, and then they tore down the real Spectrum.
Exactly. You know, you triggered a memory at the Mann Music Center. Right after they tore down the Spectrum, someone, and I imagine he was involved with possibly Live Nation or whoever owned the Spectrum, because he had like it was sitting kind of in the lot near the trucks, a big letter from the Spectrum. And I remember Trey signed it and he wanted me to sign it. And I didn't want to defile it. And he's like, yep, I want you to. And we all signed it. I wonder who has that right now. And that, any ideas?
One of the S, like the...
Yeah, it's amazing because those guys reached out to me actually when we were doing a Billy and the Kids show at the Ardmore, and they wanted Bill Kreutzmann to sign it. And they had, and they didn't get him to sign it, but they wanted him to. And they had a number of other people, and they mentioned that all the guys from Fish signed it. Okay. It has its own, I think, and you guys can, you know, fact check me on this. I think it has its own internet presence now.
Where is it?
I don't know. We can find out. I think, like I said, I think it may have its own
we can Instagram Google
account or something. But yeah, you know, when I think of the Spectrum, I think of all the being a teenager in there and looking at the cloud of smoke that was in the middle. There was just this cloud of smoke.
It was very, very fan-friendly security. But putting the Spectrum aside, Philly was always just a great Fish scene and a great place to see Fish.
No question.
You know, my fondest Philly Fish memory is probably the Keswick 92. The Keswick Theater, literally down the street from my high school, Cheltenham High School. So that was a hoot just to see Fish there. And what was funny was, you know, by then it was 92. So I was, I guess, a sophomore. No, I must have been a junior. It was fall of my junior year, I think it was. And I remember going there and seeing girls from my high school who were still in high school, but were like freshmen when I was there. And all of a sudden they're into Fish. So that was funny to see, like, this, the coming of age of like the younger, that, and by younger, I mean like 2 years younger, but still, when you're 17 or 18, that seems like a lot, you know, a bigger difference. So that was funny seeing Fish there, and a great vibe at the Keswick, which happened to be the show, the first show that John Langenstein worked for Fish, and he kicked Fishman out of the show. So I remember that was funny. He didn't let him in the stage door. He thought he was some wacko in a dress. And he's like, no, I'm the drummer in the band. So that happened to be Langenstein, longtime security, head of security with Fish. I remember that. I remember the Mann shows when they were opening for Santana. And then the next year, the 93 Mann show, one of my favorite shows. Was like an early 2001, if not the first 2001, I can't recall. And there was like the Yerushalayim Shel Zahad, and just a great, great, great show. So many great Fish shows in Philly. So I was, which is why I went down to this one.
That's a great tribute to the band Fish too, because most bands would fire the security guy that kicked the drummer out.
And that was the first night he worked for Fish. And then Fish later instead ended up
like, no, you did a really good job.
Well, they love that. Yeah. That's why they brought him back. Took him out every night.
You should be kicked. So let's finally, lots of good memories. You know, all of us were there, which is cool. Let's dive into the music. The first set has some serious highlights. And, you know, it opens with Punch You in the Eye, which is always a highlight for me. I prefer it outdoors, but it's still like probably my favorite opener. Then My Soul, and then Drowned. And we can stop here to talk a little bit about that Drowned.
Yeah, actually, Tom, let's stop here before we talk about that Drowned. Okay. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. And then when we come back, we can talk about the one thing that we haven't really mentioned yet, and that's music from this night. So we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's DistroKid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's DistroKid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
And we are back with our guest, Brad Serling. And as promised, it's time to talk about that Drowned. Brad, how do you remember it?
Well, I remember it went on for a while. I remember because I had, it was one of my friend's first Phish show, and he had shared an office with me for maybe 3 years at that point. So he'd heard a lot of Phish. So brought him down from New York for the show. And I remember him turning to, and he knew Drowned because he's a big fan of The Who. He didn't know it in the Phish context, like a lot of Phish fans really only knew it from the Halloween 95 show. So he was like, oh my God, they played this song. And then, but the Who never played it like this. So that's how I remember the Drowned was through the ears of a friend who was a big, you know, classic rock guy, but didn't necessarily know Phish. And he loved the direction that it went in. And I remember it was very different from, I think, you know, the Drowned that I always think back to is the New Year's 95 Drowned. That was just like, you know, a game changer. This one was totally different, you know, and it was very much like, this is what Fall 97 sounded like, was that Drowned. I mean, I'd say the same as like the goofiness going on in the David Bowie later in the show, and certainly the jam after Possum, that typifies Fall 97. So, you know, at the time, it didn't feel, you know, it felt like, oh, this is what they're doing these days, you know, especially coming out of the Hampton shows where things went, you know, you think of that Hood or the stuff happening at the AC/DC bag, stuff of that Hampton shows, you know, it kind of changed my view on how the band was playing. And it was even a noticeable difference from the summer. You know, summer 97 seemed like it was this transition into something we didn't know quite what, but then by the time we got into the fall, and certainly by the time you got to MSG, it was like, oh, okay, this is where this band is going now. And then 98 was really the, you know, like stretching the rubber band of what they were doing the fall 97.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. That Drowned definitely, it's, you know, I think of the 12/31/95 Drowned when anyone says the word Drowned, that's the first one that comes to mind.
I also and think of the Ventura 98 is the other one.
Yes,
I think.
Yes, absolutely. And this one was hands down, has the fingerprints of Fall 97 all over it. There's also a Couldn't Stand the Weather tease by Stevie Ray Vaughan, which I didn't know at the time because I didn't know that song.
I didn't remember that at all until I looked back at the notes and listened back to it. I did remember things like the Take Me Out to the Ball Game and the Simpsons stuff. I remember that from the boat. Like I remember where I sat, which was kind of like, it was page side, but a little bit behind. So I remember looking down and, you know, when all the goofiness was going on during the Bowie, memories of that being in the room. But yeah, I didn't remember that tease in the Drowned.
Right before we get to that Bowie, which we definitely have to get to. But before we move on to talk about the headline, which is set two, Brad, were there any other first set highlights that we should be aware of?
I mean, the 2001, you know, certainly was everything you would hope that a Fall 97. But again, at the time, we look back on it now, it seems so special. At the time, that was just how Phish played. You know, it wasn't like,
right.
Hampton was a, oh my God moment. But the rest of the tour, from what I remember going to and went listening back to the tapes, was like, oh, this is how they play now. And I don't mean to diminish the quality or be reductive of what they're doing, but it was like, oh, this is Fish. Yeah, I was like, now you listen back to it, it's like, oh, this is so crazy. Each week you could drop into any one of these songs and it'd be amazing. But at the time, it was, this was day in, day out Fish. You know, then you get to some highlights like Nutter Center or some of these other shows or the Auburn show, where you're just like, oh, yeah, where did that go? Or how did that happen? But for the Spectrum show, it's like, oh, this is just Fish today.
This is just Fish, yeah. And so we've talked about it a lot. You mentioned a couple of the you know, the funny stuff happening in it. Second set opens with David Bowie, and that was clearly a highlight of the whole show.
Yeah, and my buddy who I met, his name's Bill. So I remember Bill saying he had to whip out his trail map during the Bowie. It's like, what was, you know, and he had heard the song before and he always thought it was, you know, kind of funny and goofy. This, you know, again, think of it from a non-Fish fan's perspective, but it was a deep, well-schooled in classic rock. He just thought it was hysterical that they had this really long, highly orchestrated song that just, the only lyrics are the words, the name David Bowie. He thought that was a riot. So when he actually saw it live for the first time, and it took like 5 minutes to get into the actual Bowie. So for the first 5 minutes, you're like,
what is happening? Maze,
or is it going to be, you know, it was like flip the coin. Is it Maze or Bowie? Or, you know. But yeah, I do remember that. Interestingly, when I went and looked at my tapes and then look at Fishnet, I had it labeled as, if we jump up to the possum, I wrote Black Eyed Katie on my tape. Now at the time that was new and it was basically what it was, Moma Dance, right? Moma Dance with the lyrics, but we didn't know that at the time. So I think I was just anything that had that kind of cow funk, you know, heavy on the wah. It was like, oh, that must be Black Eyed Katie. So that's why I had it on my tapes. And it wasn't until just now before the show here that I'm like, oh, that's just being called a jam in the general parlance now. But I guess
the tail of the possum.
Well, yeah, it's not Black Eyed Katie, but it is that style of...
That's really interesting, and I want to talk about that jam in just 1 second. First, I want to just say, going back to the David Bowie, that, you know, I remember saying this back in 1.0 to my friends, but Fish just loves to play epic David Bowies in Philadelphia. You have Sits 2495 at the Man.
That's Jones Beach. The Man.
Yeah, and Jones Beach. But there's certain places that where Fish loves to pair certain songs. And Philadelphia, for some reason, they always bring out these amazing, amazing David Bowies. And it seems to, you know, really pair well. And Bowie always seems to kind of show off in Philadelphia.
It's like the Grateful Dead and Shakedown Street. There will always be a great Shakedown Street at the Spectrum.
That's
just,
right. You
know, just Broad Street was just conducive to.
That's absolutely right. So then there's this possum, and then there's a track that is just labeled as jam, as we were just talking about. You labeled it as Black Eyed Katie. Yeah. Tell us about the jam. It's definitely a very, you know, 100% fall 97 jam. But also, Brad, maybe you can give us some insight as to why Fish sometimes decides to officially label a jam out of some song with its own title. Usually just jam, or sometimes there'll be the name of the city.
Well, there's a couple of different things there. In this case, I wonder if we officially released this show, I wonder what Kevin would decide to call that. Maybe it would just be jam, but back in the day, like going back 20 years when we started Live Fish as a business, the idea with the naming, particularly what comes to mind is that when, what was it, B.B. King sat in in the Meadowlands, we had to split up all these tracks and name things jam, East Rutherford Jam 1, Jam 2. The reason was because of the mechanical licenses, which is, you know, you've got the performance and the mechanical. That's how a commercial recording works. The artist is giving us the right, or artist, you know, Fish owns Live Fish. So the artist says, yes, you can release this performance, but then you have to pay the mechanical license. And now in a streaming world, you also have to pay a performer. That's a whole other world. But back then it was just a download. And this, I don't think we were even doing CDs back then. We had to label things as these jams because we couldn't get a license for something that wasn't, particularly if it was a cover song, and if it went over 5 minutes, the rate for the mechanical license would be higher incrementally. So the, you know, the wisdom at the time, and this was coming from, you know, the band's lawyers and business managers, as well as our experience just doing licensing, was, well, let's just call it a jam and split the track at that point, if it was actually a jam, we couldn't cut it short if it was still part of whatever, let's say it was Drowned. You wouldn't cut it off in the middle of Drowned, but at a point that was clearly improvisation in the moment, that would be marked as a jam, and that's why the track marker would go there. And there would be a lot of debates. I remember during some of those early shows back when we started Live Fish, I was doing the recording, and I would sit there with Kevin Shapiro in a hotel after the show, and we would debate where we should. He was the ultimate arbiter because, he's the band's archivist and the most trusted, so really whatever he said went. But, a lot of that happened because Kevin had to answer to the business side saying, well, let's call this a jam at this point. Oh, my light's going out. Because, because of the licensing. That's how it worked.
Well, and this one is kind of different because this was never released officially. And it seems like when you listen to it, you can hear they kind of really do end Possum. And then they just keep playing, though. And it goes right into this funk, jam that then eventually dissolves into Prince Caspian.
And it has the start stop, the kind of the James Brown style start stop. I remember Fish telling a story one time about the James Brown Live in Paris album, I think it is, maybe it was 1970 or something like that they would listen to that over and over again. when they were on the Europe tour in 97, they were listening to that nonstop, and that's what got them into that whole start stop thing, which is what that jam is all about. And again, it is very similar to what Black Eyed Katie was back then, so I can see why I labeled it Black Eyed Katie, but now listening back, that's a different, it's just a jam. It's just a funk jam. So, it'd be interesting, send a note to Kevin, say, hey, what would you call this if we actually released it? Curious what he would think.
I like Tale of the Possum, but Tale of the Possum. that's really kind of, that's good insight. From your perspective, we get to hear sort of the business reasoning behind some of these naming conventions. And I've never envied all the set list people that have to figure out, is that a segue? Is that a this? What's this jam? That's pretty interesting how there's actually like a business reason behind it too.
It's been hard in a lot of recent shows. There's been full on mashups where Trey's like singing the lines from one song over another song. And it's not a big deal when they're all Who Is She, they're all owned by Fish. When they're cover songs, or it's a line from a cover song being sung over the music of a Fish original composition, that's pretty complicated. So we have to use the star, contains elements of, that's the legalese, like the proper way to credit it. It's not a separate license per se, and in a streaming world, once we launched Live Fish, the streaming service, Live Fish Plus, which was back in 2014, then we really eased up on the splitting of the songs because it got really annoying. It was one thing on CDs or certainly as downloads, because our feeling was with downloads, fans could do whatever they want. But when it's permanently in the cloud and on demand, it was really annoying to have all these splits and jams. So my feeling was always, let's stop that. Unless we absolutely have to, it's just Drowned for 22 minutes or whatever it is. And let's not split it up into, but I think that was also because by that point it was easier to license these things. Beth, God bless her, had done all this crazy work to establish all these licenses. So by the time we're in recent years of Live Fish, we already had a great track record of Fish really being a significant source of revenue for these different music publishers. So, they were not as, it wasn't as difficult to get to secure a license. Let's put it that way.
Right. I can see the opportunity like for a publisher or for a lawyer to sort of like when Trey does something complicated, like, sing music from another band on top of a Fish jam. I can see them just like popping champagne, like, yay, here we got a complicated thing that we have to solve.
There's definitely been a lot of times that I remember going into the production office and sitting with Micah, who's on the road with Fish typically and doing the edits, and like, so what are we going to do with this one? And sometimes we have to pull Jason and Patrick. Usually it's Patrick because he's, going back and forth with Trey of how, because the last thing we want is to post it, have Trey look at the app when he's in the car back to the hotel and be like, that's not what I want. Then he calls Patrick, Patrick calls Micah, it's like a whole.
Do you have a specific recent one?
I know more so with Trey Band, there were some, well, that was more because there were new songs. There were some recent ones, but with Fish, I can't remember when we actually had to repost the way. I'm thinking of that, the Dix show when like the encore was really long and spelled out, whatever, I can't remember what it was. Not the fuck your face, but it was.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's what, yeah, it was like we had something not the way Trey intended it to be in terms of how we titled it. And so we had to reach it. But there is that. So in case anyone's wondering, as far as I can tell, the first thing Trey does when he gets in the car is fire up the Live Fish app and listen to the show that just happened. And so he's always all over how we've labeled the songs if it's not something that he thought it should be. Especially if it's a new composition, that's a whole other story. But like, if it's classic Fish and like we've labeled it one way and he wanted another, we change it.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
he's the boss.
A big hint would have been that it spelled out Thark you. You should have known something as well.
Right.
All right. Tell us, we always make our guests do this. How does this night stack up against, since this is a 2-night run, the first night in Philly and then also the tour at large?
So I don't remember the first night in Philly, and I'm pretty sure I wasn't that because I think I just came in for this night back and forth and I couldn't find a tape of it. So leads me to believe I didn't tape it. For me though, in terms of the whole tour, Hampton just overshadows everything. I mean, there's just and again, I didn't go to Nutter Center, but I had that tape like most people when it started, the soundboard was widely traded shortly thereafter, which rarely happens.
Yeah.
So the Nutter Center was standing out just, in general, but Hampton just loomed so large over 30 plus years of seeing Fish. Hampton still looms that large.
Nice.
Maybe some of my favorite shows, it's hard to say, because you got New Year's 95 and things like Lemon Wheels. Yeah. I don't know that it's my favorite show, but those were like, I'd put Hampton at least up there with Island Tour, which came shortly thereafter. And so this Spectrum show sits pretty much in between Hampton. It was like, this was halfway through 14 shows into the tour or whatever it is. So you already had this whole momentum happening. And then you have the MSG run that was just like, that 12:30 show.
Outrageous.
So where this one ranks, I don't think it does rank. And I don't mean at all to say that it's bad. It's just like you had so many other massive shows. So, on either side of it. And then you had the Island Tour 6 months later, 4 months later. So, like I was saying, the fact that I never transferred it to CD just in my own listening made me think, well, one reason that's why I don't remember it much, but also I just had so much other shit to listen to from that tour.
It's a really tall mountain in the Himalayas that no one notices because it's not Everest.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because, that speaks to this tour, because as we're going through this tour, there's a lot of Salt Lake City is another one that comes to mind, where when you go back and you listen to it, it's a phenomenal show. But at the time, partially because of the way tape trading worked at the time, everyone wanted Hampton immediately. Everyone wanted Nutter Center immediately. And these kind of got, lost in the shuffle. But what made Fall 97 such a legendary tour is there's not really a bad night to be found.
Yeah, it's like May 77 Fish. Like everyone knows the Cornell show because it was a widely traded tape. But listen to the next night. Buffalo show, I think, is a way better show. Say 2 nights before. That's where I would put the Spectrum show. Yes, if you took it on its own and you had no knowledge of other Fall 97, you would think this is one of the greatest things the band has ever done. And it is, because on any given night, they were doing this. And that's kind of what I mean by, this is just what Fish is today. That's what it felt like back then. And I remember that at the time, coming back to New York, listening to the tapes. But I was still spending so much time trying to digest what had happened in Hampton that I kind of ignored this show moving forward. And then you had the couple weeks later, you had MSG. So,
Grateful Dead 577, May 77 analogy rings really true. It's the same thing, because you can't find a bad show there. And of course, a lot gets lost in the shuffle. Brad, before we let you go, we're running a little bit over time, but I wanted to get your thoughts quickly on something else entirely, which is Taboose, the Trey.
Last night's Redbird.
the reason, by the time this episode airs, the tour will be in the rearview mirror. But at the moment, as we're recording this, we're in mid-tour. And obviously you're involved with it via the Live Fish webcasts, including for a first, hosting all of Goose's sets on the Live Fish webcast. And then, of course, those sets are available later for audio streaming on the Nods app. While Trace, of course, is on the Live Fish app. It's also the first time, I think this is true. I know this is true. It's the first time that an entire trade tour has been live streamed apart from the Beacon Jams. How's that going? And just, can you give us your impressions of the tour?
Well, I thought we were going to spend this whole podcast talking about last night's Redbird. but, you know, apparently you wanted to talk about fish. It is a lot of firsts. The first time that I know of that Trey has consistently sat in with an opening act of any, you know, whether it's fish, Trey band, whatever. I can't think of any other time that something like this has happened. I also can't help but think about my friends in the Biscuits or Umphreys who are like, what the fuck? Trey never asked us. So it's hard to disassociate that part. You know, it's just funny that like,
very true.
Oh, well, let's skip a generation and let's have these guys come out. And then Trey's sitting with it, you know, think of the Biscuits would have killed for that. Or Umphreys would have like shit in their pants to have that. So, but everyone's very happy that this is happening with Goose, you know, professionally band to band. But it is kind of like, wow, that's never happened before. It is the first time that we've done live streams, both on Nugsnet and Live Fish at the same time. That took some figuring out of how to not cannibalize ourselves and market to the right people. But the argument was, you know, like, we have all these Goose fans who are Nugsnet subscribers and all these Fish fans that are Live Fish subscribers. They're not necessarily, we have, you know, a good amount that subscribe to both, but the pay-per-views need to be on both sites. And let's put the Goose sets on Nugsnet like we do every night, put the Trey sets on Live Fish. Kind of feel like maybe we should be putting the Trey audio on Nugsnet as well, but I just, you know, I didn't want to start a whole new contract, a new licensing, you know, just if this was the most expeditious way to do it. Musically, it's been, what's so exciting about it is it's something new and different. And, you know, it's very easy to get jaded, particularly from where I sit, where, you know, not only do I run the company that puts out every note these bands play every night, but I actually have to listen to it because I host a show on Sirius every week, which, by the way, shout out to Nugsnet Radio Channel 716. If you guys don't know, we have our own channel now on Sirius and the weekly live stash is back every weekend. I have to go through and listen and figure out what to play. So it's like, it's very easy to just be like, oh, it's another Umphrey show, it's another Panic show, it's whatever, and you pick out the special things. But this is the most unique thing that's come across my virtual desk in the 20 years that Nugsnet's been a business, because we've never seen anything like this kind of collaboration night after night with any band. So, you know, that's been exciting just to watch. The actual interplay between Trey and Rick has been amazing because they're so, I mean, they, I, interesting anecdote, I don't know how much time we have, but I played my buddy Goose for the first time. He lives in New Orleans. He had heard his friends had gone to see Goose. Like, what is this band? I played it for him and he's like, that's not Fish. And he wasn't belittling Goose or anything. He was just like, the tone of Rick's guitar is so similar to Trey. It's like, I was trying to explain it to him. It would be like, you know, Kimmock and Jerry playing together, where Kimmock's his own thing, but he does tonally sound very much like Jerry at certain times. Same with Rick. Rick is totally his own thing. Trey obviously his own thing, but they sound so similar. And then it's kind of like, you know, people who love to bash string cheese, which a lot of people always seem to love to bash string cheese. Kang has like the Trey pedal or the Jerry pedal, you know, he can, which is not true, but it's very, you know, very simplistic way to look at cheese. Oh, either sounds like Jerry, sounds like Trey. You could say the same thing about Rick. Oh, he just sounds like Trey. No, he doesn't. He sounds like Rick. But yes, they sound similar. So the way that they've been working that in and weaving in and out of each other, I mean, at times it sounds like the Almonds. And I don't mean the music sounds like the Almonds, but the twin guitar leads when they both start screaming together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I like the eye contact they're making and hitting those notes and making sure they hit them together. That has been the most exciting thing for me to watch and hear. Is when they've decided to do that and how. And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to watch all of the rehearsals and sound checks every day. So I'm, you know, kind of like the eye in the sky, tuning in from wherever I am at the moment, watching them go through this every day. And that's been the fun part, is to see, I mean, on one hand, it spoils, I know what they're going to play later, but to see when Trey says to Rick, hey, do this, or Rick suggests something to Trey, and Peter too, for that matter, you know, it's not just a unilateral thing. It's just amazing to see where they're deciding to hit those punch points And then to see it come off in front of the crowd is that's when it really explodes. And the crowd reaction has been amazing too.
And the live fish video for it has been so key because, as you mentioned, the tones are so close that for the first time ever, when I listen back to Trey Santana, I know who's playing what when. With this, I need the visual clue, I think, you know, because it's just
you're absolutely right. Like that was the hardest, like when he came out of Radio City, it was a little hard to tell unless you happened to see at that moment, and that camera work, frankly, wasn't that great. But the looking at, because this is Trey Kerr doing this, I mean, with help from Goose's people directing the Goose set.
Lombardi.
This is the full fish video. And just for all the fans watching at home, there's starting this summer, we had a truck out with fish dedicated to the live fish video, created and run by Trey Kerr and his whole company, Gateway. It's a game changer because now there is a dedicated semi truck, you know, a trailer being pulled by a semi with all the video gear permanently racked in there. Our encoders are permanently racked in there. Gary's in the back, which is called the hot tub. That's where he's doing the mix. It's like, you know, a mobile studio going town to town. They brought that truck on this tour. So that was the game changer and why we're able to do every night. Normally with a trade tour, it wouldn't make sense to do every night because it would cost too much. But these were arena shows. Trey's typically not playing arenas. Goose certainly isn't regularly playing arenas. So the two of them together in arenas, it made sense to bring out this truck. And the fact we're pay-per-viewing on both Nugsnet and Live Fish and putting the audio out, that's how it kind of pays for itself. We're able to do this.
I saw that truck at Portland. It's very white and very shiny. It looks brand new. It's beautiful.
It is. And it's awesome inside. It's fun to hang out in there.
I need a tour.
And there's the little lounge in the back. This is the fucked up thing is at MSG, it's going to be down on the street. So it's not going to be fun at MSG, which sucks. Right. And I usually hang out in webcast world. I'm like, where the hell am I going to hang out during the MSG run now? The truck's down the street. But it is nice. That's why this Trey Goose thing is happening and looks so good is the full-on fish rig is out there.
Nice.
And all of the amazing people who work for Trey Kerr and Gateway are making this happen, along with Goose's people who are awesome as well.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Brad Serling, for all the Trey, you know, the Tab, the Goose insight. All of us at Osiris are incredibly excited, obviously, about that pairing as well. And it's going really well. I've been lucky enough to see it live once, and I'm going to go to the Reading show. So I'm going to see the bookends, Portland and Reading. But I'm very excited about it. And as you say, it's exciting watching two really incredible guitars play together and two amazing bands when they all get up together. That's going to do it for us today. Again, Brad Serling, as always, a pleasure. Thanks to my co-host, Benji Eisen, for co-hosting, and for RJB for not co-hosting today. don't worry, he's right over there. He hasn't gone anywhere. And thanks to all of you listening for listening, and to the Osiris team, especially Eric Limarenko and Matt Dwyer, who make all this work from behind the scenes. And before you switch over to Live Fish, which our guest today would encourage you to do, let me give a quick shout out to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, trade tickets at face value. Check out all the tickets available at cashortrade.org. And if you're keeping up at home, the next show is the 12/5/97 show in Cleveland. So we'll see you on Monday for that one. And until then, blaze on while you still can. Colder weather is coming. Thanks, Brad. Thanks, Benji.
Thanks, guys. Good to see you.
Osiris.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.